Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of conversations at the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. This week, we focus on the challenge of humanitarian intervention and the role that philanthropists and other private individuals can play. In this program, we'll hear from Guy Cave, Managing Director of Geneva Global, Hadil Ibrahim, Executive Director of the Mo Ibrahim Foundation, and Lona Stahl of the Global Development Lab at USAID. This program was recorded at our Global Philanthropy Forum. And now to our moderator, Peter Lawhorn. He's president and CEO of the Conrad Hilton Foundation.
I'm supposed to set the scene, but it's a scene that you all know. We're living in an age where crisis and disaster are becoming distressingly common, whether they're natural or man-made. We're heading into a new century where climate and environmental crisis will simply become bigger. And the conflict created, or man-made disasters, have shown no signs of abating either. So clearly, we need to be preparing for a rough ride in this century. Paradoxically, we're also looking at a 15-year period where we're trying to do among the noblest things that mankind has ever done in terms of the Sustainable Development Goals, which give us a real shot at ending extreme poverty and hunger, bringing gender equality, getting all children into school, and many other goals that I know all of you hold very dear. I think we need to be frank with ourselves and say that that agenda will not happen unless we frankly and forthrightly and creatively address the humanitarian crisis of today and of the future. In 2 months, the world will come together in the first ever World Humanitarian Summit in Istanbul, called together by UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. That summit is looking at, you might call it the revitalization of the $25 billion a year humanitarian system so that it will be capable of responding to these crises of today and of the future. This panel will look at the current state of affairs in humanitarian assistance and the role of philanthropy in this complex and turbulent picture. Questions for philanthropy: how do we, as funders, move beyond a sort of morning after grant making, waking up to hear that there's been a tsunami or an earthquake somewhere in the world and something ought to be done? Even those of us who have moved into saying a better way is to look at preparedness and look at resilience, how do we think about the sort of preparedness and resilience that we'll need in the coming century? How can we be visionary in the long term? How can we be dynamic in the short term? And how can we use our funds and convening power to the best effect? And I'm sure that the panel will have very good suggestions for all of us on that. We've got a panel of three very distinguished speakers for this session. I'll keep the introduction short since they're all in your book. At my left is Hadil Ibrahim, who's the founding executive director of the Mo Ibrahim Foundation, which focuses on leadership and governance in Africa. She's also co-chair of the board of the Africa Center in New York and serves as a member of the UN Secretary General's high-level panel on humanitarian financing, the subject of this of discussion. You'll, by the way, find the panel's report has just been tweeted out. So if you want to download it and take a look later, it's well worth your attention. Guy Cave, on Hadil's left, is managing director of the philanthropic consulting firm Geneva Global, where he leads the company's program management and humanitarian response division. Guy has worked in the sector for over 20 years, over a decade with Save the Children. And on our far left is Lona Stahl of USAID, who is the acting deputy executive director of the Global Development Lab, where she focuses on two of the lab's priority initiatives, Beyond the Grid and Feed the Future. Previously, Lona was the lab's director for the Center for Global Solutions and also a senior advisor to the USAID administrator. So I wanted to start with Hadil and ask you, Hadil, what did you learn from the experience of being on a UN high-level panel? And what is it like to serve on a panel?
Okay, well, sorry, good afternoon, everyone. Maybe I can start with the human question.
Yeah.
I think certainly serving on the panel was fascinating, and I think it's very unusual that as a group of independent experts, you get the UN opening up the system for you. and giving you access and convening people. And I think that's the UN's great value add in a lot of ways, is to be a convener. So that was a really fascinating journey, because I was someone that had always worked on development issues. And for 6 months to really get to grips with this big humanitarian financing challenge and try to apply non-traditional thinking around ways to solve it was fascinating. So that speaks to that point. To give a sense of what we learned, let's start with what we were asked to do. The humanitarian assistance budget last year was $25 billion. The UN piece of that was about 12 or so billion. That means that humanitarian assistance has now overtaken peacekeeping as the single largest line item of the UN budget. That's the first time that that has happened. That 25 billion is up 12-fold from the beginning of this century, which is a huge increase and is one that seems quite difficult to explain. But let me put that in context for you. In 2014, 42,500 people were displaced every day because of climate. 42,500 people leaving their home every day. And clearly that number hasn't gone down. 42,000 by violence, 53,000 people are displaced by climate every day. Those are extraordinary numbers. That's 100,000 people leaving their homes today, forcibly, and every day. The average period that they'll be displaced for is 17 years. That, I think, was a number that really shocked us as a panel. So a Syrian walking over the border into Turkey today, statistically speaking, is not going home for 17 years. And to put that in context, that's 2 years after we're meant to have achieved the Sustainable Development Goals. So, and we may come back to this later as a panel, we are talking about leaving no one behind over a 15-year horizon with the Sustainable Development Goals, but there are 125 million people, the recipients of humanitarian aid, who will be left behind because we're not attempting to reach them, or we're not seriously bringing them into the development universe. And I think that's something that we should all be thinking about very seriously. So our challenge was to look at these 125 million people requiring aid, and again, a little more context. If they were a country, they would be the 11th largest country in the world. The 11th largest country is actually an invisible country. It's a country of people requiring assistance, who are internally displaced, who are refugees, who are stateless persons, who are not working. That's the 11th largest group of people in the world. It's not Mexico, it's not Japan. So these are significant numbers. Now, those people we give $25 billion a year to. What we as a panel tried to humbly submit was that we should be legislating about a dollar a day. So we're still talking within the realm of extreme poverty numbers, but a dollar a day for each of those people. And that's what led us to say that there is a $15 billion a year gap. And we're working off past numbers, so we can assume inflation on all of those figures. So the two things I would like to say I really learnt or would offer as priorities for this group, because obviously there are things that are really the realm of governments, really things that we recommend UN agencies need to do better. But for this group, I would suggest two things. One is bridging the humanitarian development divide. We were shocked to hear humanitarians saying that the biggest problem they face is the development community. Not barrel bombs, not the development community. The amount of competition between the two, for many complex reasons, and I think Chris alluded to it earlier, is a huge problem. They compete for the same funds from the same finance ministries, from the same other agencies. So one of the things I think the philanthropic community could really add value with would be creating the kind of bridging mechanisms that graduate people out of humanitarian fund pots. A very undignified way of putting it, and transition them into the SDG world. When you have refugee camps that have been there for 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, 50 years, as is the case now, when you have the fourth generation of families being born into refugee camps, and those refugee camps are still serviced by funding that is single year, because it's humanitarian. Refugee camps are humanitarian, so we have to treat them day by day as a crisis situation. But once a camp's been there for 15 years, surely there must be some kind of development intervention that's about getting people out of camps. I think Dadaab is either the second or the third largest city in Kenya. It's a refugee camp, a 20-year-old refugee camp. Why are we not, to use the kind of new thinking, treating this as a city? A city of 500,000 people rather than a camp of 500,000 people. So how we conceive of certain parts of the humanitarian and refugee camps, long-term protracted crises in particular, there has to be some development thinking, and I think this could be a really interesting forum to start coming up with creative ways to graduate people out of the day-by-day emergency funding of humanitarian into something that looks much more like an SDG story. Because a lot of these people aren't living in a situation of daily vulnerability. They're in a camp. The other thing I wanted to speak to is the localization agenda. Of that $25 billion a year, 0.2% of it goes to local and national NGOs. That's an incredible, I mean, again, another shocking figure, I think. 0.2% of the money we give to help people in crises is to organizations of the country, of the community. And the mind boggles. I mean, I've worked in civil society, as have many of you, for my whole career. And we talk about the importance of civil society, but we don't fund them. We would much rather fund an international NGO or a UN agency to do the work. But for myriad reasons, which Guy will also help me expand on, they are the most effective actors on the ground. And let's think about this as a long-term play. We understand the importance of robust civil society for good governance outcomes, right? So imagine a local NGO that is currently engaged in humanitarian work. What's going to happen when the war stops? They'll naturally be doing more developmental work. And 15 years down the line, when you're into the kind of middle income stage, maybe they become an advocacy NGO. They are flexible. They are more able. They're more resilient to risk, to shocks. They're more risk-taking. They understand local risk better. I will never forget going to the Turkish-Syrian border, meeting with Syrian NGOs who were trying to receive funding, and funders were saying, we need a five-year track record before we can fund you. Mm-hmm. They would say, there was no war 5 years ago. Yeah. So I think we have to be much more courageous as foundations at looking at those local NGOs and saying, that's a part that we can play. We can be those people that reach the first-line respondents and the NGOs on the ground and off the ground and support them. So, with your permission, I'll finish there for now.
Great, Ariel. And I think you've set Guy up very well. So, Guy, 20 years, we'll go from the high-level panel to the trenches. And you were 20 years in the field, Cote d'Ivoire, Myanmar, Syria. And I think some of the issues that Hadil has brought up, the 0.2%, going to local organizations and the development humanitarian divide. Could you take those a bit further?
I'd love to. And I think one of the first reflections I'd like to make is how we got here in the first place. I think the system, which is enormous, the humanitarian system with $25 billion, wasn't designed for this, and it wasn't designed for the current situation. It evolved organically through a lot of very good altruistic initiatives and impulses. And there's many things one would want to change about that for the current situation we find ourselves in and for the years to come. I'd like to focus on one of them, and it is around that localization, and it's one of the themes of the report that Hadil was involved in. It's one of the themes for the summit in Istanbul. And for a crowd like this, it seems so obvious and is part of what you're doing all the time, and yet 0.2% goes to local groups, and yet we talk about it and it doesn't get better, is the reality. And yet, in every situation I've been in, inside northern Syria, in Lebanon, Jordan, Myanmar after a cyclone, Cote d'Ivoire in civil war, as soon as you get to a community or an area that's been hit by these various types of shocks and disasters, you find the community, of course, already responding. You know, we have very good humanitarian principles, but the idea of humans helping humans is as old as time itself and is evident in every culture and religion and place that you can think of. And so communities are the first responders. Communities are also the ones who are there when everybody has pulled out and funding has dried up. They're the ones who know the situation on the ground the quickest. They don't have to bring in experts to do multi-sectoral rapid assessments and then send a message back and set up procurement and logistics chains. Very often with small amounts of cash and real empowerment, not subcontracting from INGOs or from UN or anybody else, but actual empowerment and cash, they can respond to the immediate needs around them in the community. So, and they're fast and they're flexible, and of course they're trusted by the community. And I think the Ebola response was a really good example, which also comes out of the panel, of knowing at what level different people need to respond. And there was a need for, you know, INGOs and UN specialized agencies, et cetera, to do the medical quarantine work and the medical treatment in the Ebola crisis. But at the community level, there was actually a lot of resentment and rejection and suspicion around people coming from outside into the community with life-saving messages around how you should bury people and how you can avoid contracting Ebola, et cetera. But communities and the Ebola Ebola Crisis Response Fund funded a lot of just very local grassroots work spreading that message, and it was immediately more accepted because these groups are trusted by the community. We talk a lot around humanitarian access, and I remember being in the end of 2012, early 2013, smuggling myself across the Turkey-Syria border into northern Syria with some others to help set up humanitarian work there before it quickly became too dangerous for those of us who were expats to do that. And of course, already you had people responding, and already you had access to areas that now international agencies can never get safe access to. So we talk a lot about humanitarian access, but it needs to not just be where the international agencies get access to, but recognizing that you can fund local groups and they always have the access. Local response is efficient, it supports local markets, and we need to just look at the whole humanitarian system and say, how do we move, you know, the subsidiarity principle, right? How do we move the response and devolve the responsibility and decision-making to the lowest, to the nearest level to the crisis possible? So we all know all of that it's a good thing, but I'd like to build on what Chris and Jane were saying earlier around what's the role of philanthropy in this, and how can philanthropy coalesce and create a coalition that can then actually serve as an example to others and to the wider humanitarian system. And it is, I think, very much around philanthropy capital being flexible and fast and not having to have the bureaucracy, like Hadil was saying, around requiring financial records for years and registration and this and that, that become blocks. And philanthropic capital is often more willing to take risks. Maybe you'll fund 20 local groups responding in northern Syria, and one or two of them, you can't ever really be sure what happened, can't be sure of the impact, you know, it was well-meaning, etc. And that idea of successful failing has become very difficult to do within, I think, the UN and INGOs, but philanthropy has a real role there. Philanthropy and that kind of business mindset to it values local knowledge, values efficiency. And importantly, as was also mentioned earlier, is independent of politics. There's been a lot of political maneuvering caught up in some of the humanitarian response, and philanthropy can avoid that. So for me, philanthropy has a real opportunity to fill the gap and push localization. And I think the way to do that, though, efficiently, is through pooling philanthropic funds for humanitarian response. And I think there's examples of that that I could cite. I mean, in Myanmar, Burma, which was brought up earlier, after Cyclone Nargis in 2008, a coalition of us got together and funded hundreds of local groups to respond over a kind of the immediate phase and the recovery phase. And it had an enormous impact, and has had an ongoing impact because, as Hadil was saying, it's empowered civil society, and now that network, which is called Pongku, which kind of means the bridge or the connector in Burmese, is now an independent, vibrant part of civil society and of strengthening civil society within the new Burma. Last couple of things, I think philanthropic capital also has an opportunity to deal with the root causes, to deal with disaster risk reduction, deal with peace building, and some of the kind of neglected areas of the world in terms of, you know, Central African Republic, Yemen now, South Sudan, these areas that go in and out of humanitarian to development, which I agree is a kind of false and unhelpful dichotomy. And also to fund areas such as education in Lebanon for Syrian refugees that is often neglected in an emergency response and yet is so important for the future.
Great guy, thank you. And I know that both you and Hadil, your emphasis on the grassroots, the community-based, the locally-based organizations that don't distinguish between what's humanitarian and what's developmental will have a lot of resonance with many of the funders in the audience. And I hope we have a robust dialogue on that moving forward. Now, if we can go from the, if you like, the micro and the now to Lana at USAID, who I know has ideas about trends and the future and innovation and technology. Lana?
Great. Well, thank you. And to ground where USAID is in all of this, last year alone, we were part of responding to 65 disasters in over 50 countries and $6 billion last year alone. And that's USAID out of a $22 billion budget. And then where I sit within the agency is a part of USAID called the US Global Development Lab, which has existed for 2 years and seeks to really bring innovation, technology, and smart risk-taking to produce breakthroughs that help us get to the Sustainable Development Goals, and then to really think of new ways of partnering as well. And so with less than 1% of USAID's budget, really try to be transformational, in particular work with a lot of the organizations in this room in doing that. So I'd put on the table, when you look to the future, two big ideas. One is that pulling on what's in the report, and I think has to be part of this dialogue, is how do we actually shrink the need in the future? And so how do we look at what in USAID we call resilience programming that is a critical part of this equation? And then the second piece is how do we actually use innovation, technology to find new solutions to add to our cookbook that also mean we can solve challenges more cost effectively and sustainably? And I think there's a critical role for philanthropy in both of those. So let me start with resilience. There's a Chinese proverb I've heard my colleagues in the Shell Foundation use, that the second best day to plant a tree is today. And that is indicative of, we have to start now building more resilient communities and systems so that the need in the future is less. And there's some really concrete examples of things we could mobilize on that get at this. So one that I put on the table is digital financial systems. You might know them as mobile money. We found, and there was a study by MIT in 2011 that looked at Kenya, which has M-Pesa, one of the most advanced mobile money systems in the world, and found that during periods of shock, families who were part of M-Pesa were able to weather the shock without the 7% drop in consumption that you saw in families in the same communities that were not part of M-Pesa. And so the resilience of people's natural networks, if we enable it through technology and through new approaches at money, can be a critical piece of underpinning how you create resilience. Another is thinking about insurance in different ways. So technology, satellite data, weather information enable us to help communities have invest in ways to create their own resilience. So there's one example is the Global Fund for Disaster Risk Reduction. Just in the last couple of weeks, the Kenyan government has put forward a national agricultural insurance fund. USAID, in partnership with others, is working on these kinds of insurance approaches all across Africa, and it's a critical part of this equation. You can also use satellite data to understand where you're most likely to see shocks in the system in the future, and to also help increase the speed at which you can respond when a crisis happens. So one example of this kind of mapping for resilience happened around the Nepal earthquakes last year, where the Geo Center in USAID, which is part of the lab, in conjunction with local universities in Nepal, had mapped out where all of the critical locations were in Nepal, so that when the earthquake hit, the first responders, both local and international, knew where things were and could respond far more effectively. We've also used satellite and weather imagery in places like Ethiopia to look at helping local communities have access to information on where the best places to graze their herds are. And in an approach that USAID has partnered with Project Concern International and that is now being scaled with a number of other partners, including Google, have looked at using satellite weather data, putting it in the hands of local communities that then through their own local information dissemination process get it out to herders, have been able to reduce livestock mortality by 47%. And that's critical in places like Ethiopia that are one of the chronic places that you see these kinds of weather shocks. You can also really use real-time data systems to rapidly increase the ability to get information to communities and get feedback from those communities to local governments as well as international responders. And the Ebola response is one example of this, and almost more importantly, the way we're right now working with the ministries of health in West Africa to ensure that their health information systems are robust and include real-time data feedback that will both enable greater effectiveness now and mean that there's far more resilience in the case of a future outbreak. And then finally, I'd say on this resilience piece, how do we help local individuals and communities who have an idea on how to solve a challenge that community is facing, take that idea and move it forward? So I want to build on that and moving to the second big idea that I had put on the table. Saying, though, to wrap this section up, that we've learned that for every dollar we spend in resilience, it gives us $3 worth of development impact. So it's also a very cost-effective way of thinking about how we tackle these challenges. So on the second piece, in terms of how do you use innovation and technology and new approaches to help reduce the cost of these responses and have more sustainable solutions, USAID very much has put science and technology at the heart of how we think about global challenges and really believe that good ideas are everywhere, even if opportunity is not. And so one of the things we've been doing for the last several years is really opening up problems to good ideas anywhere. And so we've launched 6 grand challenges for development. We've really, since 2010, doubled the amount of investments we make directly into local governments, civil society organizations, and local businesses. And in these grand challenges have, and we also have a program, Development Innovation Ventures, and we found that 50% of the applicants who are coming with ideas have never worked with USAID before. And these are often the kinds of local organizations that struggle to figure out how to partner with an organization like USAID, but we've been very deliberate in trying to make the bar of where they have to be able to the bar they have to meet in order to partner with us, reasonable for the kind of organization they are. And so right now we have a global partnership for resilience with Rockefeller Foundation and the Swedish International Aid Agency that is launching different challenge funds. One that's open right now is for flood-prone areas, and this partnership is overall $160 million. It's really trying to bring innovation and technology to find new solutions to these problems, often supporting local innovators. But what I'd say is we've found we're very good at bringing in new ideas, and we can do more of that, but we've been able to bring in thousands of new ideas in this way. What's harder is really helping them be sustainable. And so the kind of nurturing that it takes to get them to sustainability and impact, I'll give you the data from, again, Shell Foundation, which has found that it takes 5 to 10 years and $5 million to $20 million in order to get an organization to where they have the customer base and the cash flow or if they're government, the real government, if it's a public solution, the government buy-in and rollout to where they can be sustained without continued support from organizations like philanthropy or donors. And so that kind of role of how do you bring the early stage investment but the patient capital to help these good ideas get to where they have sustained impact is something I think philanthropy plays a critical role in. And it's part of why USAID, along with the World Affairs Council, the Higher Life Foundation, and a number of others, have stood up the African Philanthropy Forum, because we also think local angel investors and local philanthropy are critical parts of this solution. And we really are excited to continue to look at how can we play a useful role in facilitating that kind of early stage patient capital, thinking about systems and how by working together we can really get to sustained impact against these challenges, which if you look at them from the SDG standpoint, you have 2.5 billion people who don't have access to sanitation. You have 1.2 billion in Africa alone that don't have access to energy. So these are problems at a magnitude that requires us to figure out how to work together. And so I just close by saying I do think there's a critical role for philanthropy in investing in the systems right now that can build resilience. So that's everything from the digital financial services to weather-based insurance products to thinking about how technology and feedback loops can feed into this. And then also bringing new ideas into the mix through this early stage patient capital. And would love to understand better from all of you where you think USAID's comparative advantages. So one of the things we're doing is, with a colleague of mine, we're gonna host a breakfast tomorrow. So anyone that's interested in understanding more how USAID plays in this space, we're happy to also continue the conversation outside of the panel. So.
Great, thanks, Lana. A real rich set of ideas.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of conversations at the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We're hearing from three experts who are discussing humanitarian assistance in times of crisis. They are Guy Cave, Managing Director of Geneva Global, Hadil Ibrahim, Executive Director of the Mo Ibrahim Foundation, and Lona Stahl of the Global Development Lab at USAID. This program was recorded at our Global Philanthropy Forum. The World Affairs Council is a membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public and conversations that matter. You can join us at worldaffairs.org. And now back to our conversation.
Now, if we can move into a little bit more of lightning round of exchange. Hadil, I wanted to ask you, the World Humanitarian Summit that's coming up in Istanbul, I think the scene has been set for this is high stakes. And the scene has also been set for we don't know or the system is not high functioning. If you were a betting panelist, what would you bet on as outcomes from the WHS?
Wow. I think what you can expect to see from the summit, and I think some of you, I think there are some side events on Foundation, so some of you may be joining. I think you can expect to see movement in two places. I think on the issue of the grand bargain, and for those that haven't read the report, which I'm sure is the majority, what we really tried to put forward were ways in which the UN and donors, that whole ecosystem could improve. I think it was quite a challenging report in that sense. So one of the things we started with was looking at how if donors, such as our friends at USAID, made more multi-year funding available with less earmarking, less bureaucracy, could agencies such as World Food Programme respond by being more transparent and more accountable to get that money. So it's this kind of grand bargain that has at its heart transparency and accountability, but a lessening of bureaucracy and, as many of you know, the kind of tyranny of the log frame of having to endlessly reapply and reapply for funding. I think there'll be movement on that. The Dutch government in particular have been very enthusiastic about that. The same kind of grand bargain was at the heart of the Secretary General's report, which came out just after our report. So I think where you can expect to see progress are where the key players are UN agencies or governments, because frankly, they're the kind of people that own a summit process of that type. So they're the kind of people that will all be in the room in Istanbul and able to strike a deal. Similarly, one of the recommendations we made was UN agencies, and some of you will know this from having worked with them, are deeply competitive with each other. And that's largely a function of member states and funding agencies want them to compete with each other. In fact, one big donor country said to me, yeah, we want all these UN agencies to be much more competitive in a kind of private sector kind of way, and then we can decide which is better and which is worse and fund accordingly. I mean, the idea that the World Food Programme and UNHCR should be actively competitive in how they approach a refugee camp shows that we sometimes have this obsession with applying free market principles, even in places which are basically free market failure, examples of free market failure. So I think that was, we basically tried to encourage a move towards what we called collaborative efficiency. We think competition in the humanitarian space is inefficient. We think what you need is collaborative efficiency, where we all know what each other are doing, we're all leveraging off what each other are doing, we understand comparative strengths, and, you know, I may channel resources towards another NGO because they have more capacity and more experience in that area, and that's fine. So it will be interesting to see what moves happen within the UN agencies around that, and how donors fund agencies in ways that encourage them to collaborate more, because it's all incentives, and at the moment the incentives are dysfunctional, unfortunately. So on that side, I think you'll see progress. Is that sufficient progress?
Do you think that, in a just a 30-second response, what are you most worried about?
I'm going to be very provocative because I'm among friends.
Yeah.
I hope. You asked me, Guy, a very good question earlier, which was what didn't get into the report that you wanted in the report, which I thought was a fantastic question. Look, we talk about the cost of Security Council in action. And I think there was a lot of discussion and a lot of considerations around what is the cost of a Security Council veto on a humanitarian crisis. I mean, we have given management of the peace and security cluster to the members of the Security Council. That's their responsibility. If they fail to act, and millions of people die as a consequence of that, can they be held legally responsible? Mm-hmm. Can they be held financially responsible? I think that was a really interesting discussion that appeared, and I think it's safe to say will not happen in Istanbul.
Okay. And you were also saying, I assume we're clapping for Hadil's bravery and not for that outcome, but you were also saying, I think, that the appropriation for peacekeeping missions was something like $200 million.
Peace building, I think, is around $200 million. So just to put it in perspective, we can raise $25 billion a year to clean up the mess. Some of the mess, but we can't raise $200 million a year to prevent the mess actually happening. That's how we structure financing in this space.
Which also might be an agenda to take on among people in this room. Guy, you and I are both recovering Save the Children staffers, and looking at the 0.2 percentage that was mentioned before, what is the role of international NGOs in that percentage being so low? And what can this room do to help international NGOs move forward in that way?
That's a great question. And I know the answer to the second one, I think, really is around how can philanthropy model the way to do good, localized humanitarian response? How can we do that? I'm slightly pessimistic about the World Humanitarian Summit. I'm slightly pessimistic about the ability of NGOs to really reform the system, or for UN agencies with their different mandates and different metrics of success for the CEOs of NGOs and the heads of UN agencies to actually make that change and give up money and give up power and empower local civil society in humanitarian response. So I think, having tried to change that system from within, I think philanthropy has that capacity to really make a big difference and show a way forward that then others can follow.
And speaking of ways forward, and to just share the discomfort a little bit among all the panelists, and I ask this, Lana, with respect and affection for USAID, but it has been hard for USAID to support very local organizations in its past. If we look at PEPFAR, the massive amounts of money to large organizations. If you were to follow the recommendations of Guy and Hadio, and also tell us a little bit about USAID Forward and where that's heading, does USAID have a dynamic for changing this percentage?
Yeah, thank you for that. And it has been a critical part of the USAID Forward agenda that was put on the table at the very beginning of this administration. And ultimately, at the end of the day, we think about it as sustainability. We are all in this business because we want to have an impact on the world. And so I think going back to the behavior change, a big part of the role for all of us is if you can show that the way you're approaching the problem has greater impact, is more sustainable, and is cost effective, it's much easier to convince even large bureaucracies to move in that direction. And that's a little bit of the model we've taken within the lab, within the much larger USAID bureaucracy, is recognizing the passion of the people in the agency and that they, at the end of the day, want to really feel like they're bringing positive social good to the world as well. On the question of working through local organizations, I'd say we are funded with taxpayer dollars, and that means there is a whole lot of ornaments on the Christmas tree in terms of various boxes that have to be checked and various things that we are very much held accountable for. And the conversation around risk and smart risk is an important one that we have with Congress on an ongoing basis. I'm there a couple days every week meeting with different representatives, staff members, and senators. And they are very conscious of having to say to the American people that these dollars were spent in a really good, responsible way, and no, they're not funding terrorist organizations. So I just say this is something within the agency, we're framing it around sustainability. And so that is a very country-specific question of what's the best way to support there being local organizations, local governments, local actors that can carry forward the development agenda of that country. And a large part of the financing for development conversation last summer was really about domestic resource mobilization and how you bring different sources of revenue in to solve this problem that are far more sustainable than USAID funds. And so I think that has to be part of it, the role of the Save the Children's and the World Visions and the Catholic Relief Services. Often there is a very critical role for them to play in building the capacity of the local organizations, but they should also be working themselves out of a job. And so what that looks like is very different in each country context, and I think what we all, if we move to a world where sustainability is one of the core things we're looking at, and we're just as interested in what the impact of a project is 5 years after it ends as we are the day it ends, it will help push some of the kinds of change that we're seeking to achieve. And I would say philanthropy has a critical role because you're not as beholden to the politics and to, Congress the way some other organizations are. And so you can play a lead by example role in saying this is the approach that makes sense in this context and we're gonna lead. And then others can follow in your footsteps.
Great, Lana, I think Hadio, that sets you up pretty well, right? Lana mentioned the risk profile that different actors are willing to take on and clearly staked out the government naturally in the middle. Foundations have the capacity and the potential to take greater risks. How do you think they're doing?
How do we all think we're doing? Let me be the provocateur on the panel. I come from the foundation world. I am of the foundation world. I can see one of my esteemed colleagues from the Clinton Foundation board here in front of me, Donna. I've worked with many of the foundations in this room. I'm worried that we're forgetting our role is to be laboratories for social justice. that's what we're here for. Or if not for social justice, climate justice. Thank you. Someone agrees with me. But our job is to be a laboratory. We do not have the same reporting governance requirement that Lorna does, clearly. And yet, in a lot of the work I did on governance at the more progressive end of the governance scale with the Mo Ibrahim Foundation, I found bilateral donors and international institutions more supportive of the risks we were taking than other foundations. Genuinely. It's crazy. So I think at some point, while we institutionalize, we professionalize, we recognize that we want to be seen as serious, consistent, thoughtful entities, if we're not willing to take risks and we're not willing to make mistakes, then this might as well be public money. So I think we have to be much more risk-taking, we have to be much more courageous, we have to look at that Syrian NGO, for example, localization crisis, and say, it's our job to fix this. And yes, some of that money might go astray, but at the end of the day, you only have to answer to yourselves. You don't, unlike Lorna, have to turn up on Capitol Hill and explain why this bag of rice is in the hands of Al-Shabaab. So it is our defined role. I mean, when you look at the universe, that's where we're supposed to be. And if we take this agenda of only 0.2% of humanitarian goes to local NGOs, let me make a suggestion for all of us. Why don't we agree an amount? A guideline, 15%, 20%. I mean, somewhere to start. It wasn't long ago that on panels like this, if there wasn't a single woman there, no one would notice. Or if there was no ethnic diversity, no one would notice. But now we're kind of ashamed if we don't have diversity. So how about doing that in a localization agenda? You look at your portfolios, you look at how you fund these things, and if 20% of the money going to Syria isn't going to Syrian NGOs, you should feel a bit ashamed.
In my notes there, it said pause for applause. I'd now like to open up to questions from the audience. Please raise your hand. And I will point you for questions one at a time. If you're called on, please stand up and introduce yourself, and please keep your questions concise so that as many participants as possible can speak. Provocative is fine, but please make it concise.
Steve Alderman from the Peter C. Alderman Foundation. Enjoyed your presentation. My question is we know that the SDGs are going to be a departure in funding from the MDGs. There's got to be a new, for want of a better word, paradigm. How are we going to do this? How is philanthropy going to lead it? And did the Ethiopia conference in July shed any light on this? Thank you.
Maybe I should use the chair's prerogative and answer a little bit of the question before. Lana, would you like some as well? In terms of philanthropy's role in advancing the SDGs, I think it's an excellent question. Foundations put about several hundred million dollars into the MDGs without knowing it, because they weren't aware of the overall agenda and they didn't play into it. So lots of leverage opportunities were missed. I think in the SDGs we can do much better, and that's why a number of foundations, MasterCard, Ford, Hilton, are working with UNDP, the Foundation Center, Rockefeller Philanthropy Advisors, to really make it easier for foundations to get involved in the SDGs in terms of who their opposite numbers would be in the UN system, in national governments, and vice versa, to identify good opportunities and to really ask the global community to use the comparative advantages of foundations, the long-term vision, the short-term we can do something tomorrow, and the ability to bring people together in ways that will lead to the accomplishment of the goals and not simply the incremental improvement year to year. So I think there are important platforms that are already out there, and people should share during the meeting other ways that give foundations the opportunity to play a generative role in this. And Lana, I wonder if you wanted to add anything?
Sure, I'd do a two-part answer. So one part is it both requires new sources of funding, of which one critical one is domestic resource mobilization, as well as how do we challenge the current cost structures of what it takes to get to those goals. And then to illustrate that, I'd use the example of energy access for all. There's been a movement for a few years now that led to the SDG goal around access to energy. Part of the answer is extension of the grid, and there's a global effort in Africa, Power Africa. There's other efforts in other parts of the world. And part of the answer is also off-grid, because if you want to get energy access for all, including those 125 million living in refugee camps or displaced, it's not just going to be a grid solution by 2030. And so part of what we're doing is we USAID, but as a convener, is thinking about how can we actually help sustainable solutions to off-grid access to energy, which we think there's emerging, industry there that we can help support reaching scale if we work together. And so that includes the patient capital, the early stage investing in the entrepreneurs that want to step into that space, as well as various global approaches like the Global Off-Grid Lighting Association that play a market facilitation role in this space too. And so there's a lot we're looking to do in partnership with foundations and others that will help that kind of very sustainable, very local-driven approach to connection to energy access. And that's something where we play with some of our funding that early stage investment role, but to the conversations of the panel to date, our funding is insufficient and we have a lot of constraints on it. So would love to see philanthropy playing a big role, and how do you bring innovation, how do you bring sustainable solutions specifically against those goals in the SDGs.
Great. And so two websites to visit, sdgfunders.org and the Global Goals Innovation Challenge, right, from the development lab?
So we've launched a Global Goals Innovation Challenge, and so this is a window open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Organizations that have never partnered with USAID before can say, I have an idea on how to reach a SDG target. And so that's one avenue, but we should all think, when you look at the specific goals, on what are the ways we can come together and bring our respective comparative advantage to bear against these really important goals.
Thanks. And I think we had one more question up here in the front.
Hi, thank you. Samira Mehra from Charities Aid Foundation. So at CAF, we've been following a couple of developments. One has been balancing the need for transparency and accountability and getting funds down to local organizations whilst making sure we're avoiding terrorist financing activities, but versus the risk of overregulation due to Recommendation 8 in the Financial Action Task Force. The other development is the increasing trend of a number of countries, 60 in the past 3 years, that have introduced regulations on civil society. And this can be in terms of restrictions on receipt of foreign funds, restrictions on what you can donate and who you can donate to overseas. And predominantly, it's focused on human rights organizations or advocacy NGOs. So how it would be great to get your thoughts on how we can address this as civil society together collectively to ensure that there is not an overemphasis or a skewed discussion on answering the question of how we can help poor people, so to speak, but why they're poor in the first place and addressing the root causes. Thank you.
Adele, you want to?
Sure. Look, I think it's a really, really powerful question. I say this with my African, with my sort of UN associated hat firmly off. The civic space is closing globally, we know this, and I wouldn't say that's just the case in Africa. I think that's around the world we're seeing civil society. And for those of you that haven't seen the Civicus report, I think it was last year or the year before that specifically looked at this issue and did an analysis of the global civic space, and it's shutting down. I think one of the big problems is that this intellectual clamping down on foreign funding for NGOs by certain of our governments is profoundly intellectually inconsistent with their own behavior. Every one of these governments accepts foreign funding in one form or another. They accept loans from foreign banks, they accept funding from foreign donors, that there's this extraordinary, do as I say, not as I do, that's what national sovereignty is. And I'm not sure sovereignty is the word for that. So I think it is something to be genuinely concerned about. But of course, you know, many NGOs that we know are having to work without foreign funding or shut down, and there's no immediate answer. But I think the inflection point has to be in more constructive communication with government, and that requires a lot more coordination between foundations working in this space with other entities, and foundations being much clearer. I mean, when we started doing civil society work in Africa about a decade ago, it was assumed that if you were civil society, you opposed government. That was the job of civil society, to be oppositional. I would say now most of the governments we engage with think we're a partner. They think we add value, so they listen to us when we're critical, and we find ways to be critical that maybe aren't publicly shaming of them if it's unnecessary. So I would say where we see this to be a growing problem, I think it's very worth looking at building a coalition of the willing that can demonstrate in the countries they've worked in and that they're concerned about where they've added value. And at that aggregated level, I think you can have constructive engagement with almost any government. I mean, some of the governments we now have really good relationships with in Africa, I would have said 10 years ago that was impossible. But it wasn't shouting at them that got them to listen. It was showing that we weren't there to be their enemy. We were there to help the country.
All right, and now the biggest challenge of the day. I'd like each of you to give a 30-second, 140-character takeaway for the room. What's the most important thing for them to be thinking about? Starting with Lana.
Okay, so I'd say we should not focus on humanitarian assistance as something that exists alone, but really focus on resilience. How do we, yes, tackle things that are happening today in crisis, but how do we also change the systems so that the need in the future is less? And so that's one thing.
Only one then. Sorry, that's 30 seconds.
Okay.
I'm coming against it. Yeah, Guy?
That in the humanitarian system, from start to finish, there are different roles best played by different people, but a major part of philanthropy's role, I think, can be pushing the localization of humanitarian assistance.
Great. Khalil?
If you'll indulge me, I just wanted to finish with a quote that I thought summed up all the how we treat refugees at the moment, or what refugees are facing at the moment, which is from a Viennese essayist of the mid-20th century, and it's not very long, I promise, who was a refugee himself, Alfred Polgar, and he said, "Abel, if he had fled from the murderous attentions of his brother Cain, would, as an emigrant, have had to put up with an even more bitter inconvenience. He would have had to wander the world for the rest of his life with the brand of Abel on his forehead." And I ask all of you to ensure that these people we're trying to help do not bear the brand of victim or Syrian, everything they've lost, everything they're trying to run away from. And if we keep the individual at the center of what we're trying to do, I think the outcomes will change dramatically.
Great. Well, I think it's been a rich discussion. I'd like you all to keep the ideas in mind today as you head into the working group sessions, which begin promptly at 3 p.m. In particular, there's a session that focuses on strategies to support and protect the most vulnerable of the displaced. And our hope is that this conversation and our commitment to those affected by humanitarian crisis can add value to the problem-solving exercises that you will be engaged in throughout the rest of the conference. I want to thank our speakers for their insights and our audience for their participation.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of conversations at the World Affairs Council. Featured in this program were Guy Cave of Geneva Global, Hadil Ibrahim of the Mo Ibrahim Foundation, and Lona Stahl of the Global Development Lab at USAID. They were in conversation with Peter Lawhorn, and he's the president and CEO of the Conrad Hilton Foundation. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. You can join us by visiting worldaffairs.org. This weekly program is made possible by the generous support of Chevron. Additional funding for post-production is provided by Maria Starr. She's a member of the KQED Producer Circle. Our recording engineer is Jim Bennett. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.